Post-apocalyptic Christmas greetings and salvation, my extra-refined listeners, and welcome to this December 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this innovative, old, agey-wagey science podcast, Jim Campanella. Well, did you survive the Mayan end of the world? Yeah, well, me too. Even most of us living in New Jersey survived. I'll refrain from saying I told you so to all you who were predicting this was the big one, but science won again. Nyah, 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 nyah. All right, I got carried away, sorry. We may blow up tomorrow, we may blow up the next day, but December 21st, 2012 was just not it. I guess the guy who was making that Mayan calendar just got tired of carving, after all. Just to keep up with the theme of doom and destruction, let me pass along a question that regular listener Paul Hauser emailed to me. Paul wanted to know how the seagrass population off the coast of Jersey fared after Hurricane Sandy. Paul asked this because he remembered my role in studying the population genetics of the species. I told him that I am a lab guy and not a field biologist, and I frankly had no idea. But I would pass the question along to one of my collaborators, Dr. Paul Bologna, who is a conservation biologist. I did this, and Dr. Bologna told me that he has not been out on Barnegat Bay since the storm blew through. However, he did give me his thoughts on how the Zostera marina populations managed. He pointed out to me that Zostera are usually in deeper water, from 5 to 10 feet in depth, and that even with storm surges, minimal damage was likely to occur. His basis for that assessment was that Zostera have thick, fibrous root systems that are heavily interlocked by rhizomes. Essentially, the stems of the grasses are held to the bottom by a mat of heavily interlaced roots. Since the plant would be held in place so well, Zostera would have been pushed flat by the storm surges, but not pulled out of the soil. However, Bologna pointed out to me that even though Zostera probably did fine, other seagrass species were probably decimated. The species Rubia, for instance, was probably ripped up wholesale because that plant has very shallow root systems that do not interlock like Zostera does. Well, Paul, there is my answer. In spring, we'll see just how much damage actually occurred out there. The first official story of the night is so damn weird that I just had to pass it along. I am still not sure how to take it at all, actually. Texas veterinarian Dr. Melba Ketchum says that she has sequenced the genome of Bigfoot. This work has not been published in any scientific journal, and it has not met with any academic scrutiny at all. It was released in a press release. Now, what did I say a couple of months ago about the pitfalls of releasing scientific data in that manner? Yeah, I think my words were, it's a bloody bad idea. Ketchum says that she has sequenced Bigfoot based on samples of hair and tissues that were collected in the woods all over North America. No, she does not say that she has directly sampled Bigfoot for DNA. Now that would be crazy, wouldn't it? According to her press release, Ketchum's team sequenced 20 whole mitochondrial genomes and 3 whole nuclear genomes from the purported Sasquatch samples. Now remember that mitochondria are the tiny generators found in each cell that supply power. They actually carry their own DNA inside of them. In mammals, the mitochondria, along with the DNA, is almost always inherited directly from the maternal line, not from the paternal line. Ketchum allegedly found that her Sasquatch's mitochondrial DNA was identical to that of modern humans, but that the nuclear DNA was a, quote, novel unknown hominid, resulting from males of an unknown hominin species that contain distinctly non-human, non-archaic, hominid, and non-ape sequences, unquote. So I guess that Ketchum is saying that this Bigfoot is some sort of anthropoid hybrid? That statement from her press release is nothing if not opaque. I have no idea if that is what she was getting at, but if she is or was, then it poses a biological problem that she would not be able to explain. Namely, if Sasquatch is a hybrid between a primate more distant from the great apes and humans, their genomes would be incompatible. They wouldn't be able to reproduce. So, they would not exist in the first place. Ketchum's logic leaves a bit to be desired. It's possible that Ketchum actually did sequence Bigfoot, but it's more likely that she sequenced just plain trash. My colleagues who do environmental forensics work tell me that it's actually pretty easy to pick up human mitochondrial DNA because of ubiquitous contamination, and that the nuclear DNA could represent environmental noise, more contamination of yeast or fungi or other microorganisms, very common occurrences for any forensic sample. To do the work correctly, you need to have fairly clean environmental samples, do lots of controls, and have very specific sequencing reactions for what you're looking for. Also, the kind of computer sequence analysis that you need to do can be easily misinterpreted or confused. I've done them for years now myself, and I still get tagged when I turn in research to a journal with a paper and make a mistake. As a colleague of mine pointed out, your DNA analysis is only as good as what goes into the program to be analyzed. Garbage in and garbage out, as the computer code monkeys say. Well, Ketchum says that her work is being peer-reviewed right now, so we may yet see what her results look like. Certainly, I will not make any prejudgments here until the data becomes publicly available. Wow, my next story came out just today. The Nobel Prize Committee is being sued by Dr. Rongjiang Zhu. Dr. Zhu alleges that the Nobel Assembly incorrectly credited the winners of the 2012 Prize in Medicine or Physiology for stem cell research that he actually pioneered a decade earlier. If you did not follow the Nobel Prizes this year, Drs. John Gurdon and Shinya Yamanaka won the 2012 Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology for the discovery that mature cells can be reprogrammed to become pluripotent. That's a major breakthrough because it was thought that once animal cells matured, they were stuck at the end of whatever developmental program they were following. That is, heart cells could only be heart cells, lung cells only lung cells, only brain cells, etc. The award recognized Gurdon's 1962 discovery that a cell's maturation could be reversed, and then Yamanaka's 2006 discovery of how to reprogram mature cells into less developed cells. Zhu says that he discovered Yamanaka's breakthrough in the 1980s. He says that published research in 1984 demonstrated that stable differentiated cells could be reverted to a pluripotent state. Additionally, Zhu states that in 2000, he and his research team allegedly awakened intact mature somatic cells to turn into pluripotent stem cells without any genetic engineering techniques such as Yamanaka performed. Therefore, Zhu claims that the Nobel statement undermines his accomplishments and defames his reputation. Zhu insists that the suit is not sour grapes because he did not get the Nobel Prize. He says, quote, "My main interest is in rehabilitating my dominant position as the owner slash pioneer of the scientific achievement characterized in the publication at issue," unquote. Zhu demands a jury trial to determine whether the Nobel Assembly owes him financial damages in the millions and whether it should repeal parts of its descriptions of Gurdon's and Yamanaka's prize-winning work. Do I have any thoughts on this nonsense?
My mama said, if you don't have anything good to say about somebody, don't say nothing at all.
You know, that's pretty good advice. I suspect that many of you have heard the next story, but if you have not, according to Dr. David Page of NASA, frozen water can actually be detected on the planet Mercury. Page published this research work in the journal Science at the end of November. To me, this is just incredible because if you had asked me to bet which planet was least likely to have water, Mercury would have been my number one choice. Page's observations of Mercury's northern polar regions come from the MESSENGER spacecraft, which is orbiting Mercury. The MESSENGER has a laser altimeter, which maps the planet's topography and measures how reflective the surface is. Simulations of Mercury's surface temperatures match the laser measurements, and inside shadowy, steep-walled craters, temperatures are below minus 173 degrees Celsius. So cold that frozen water can certainly exist there. There are shiny areas in those deep-walled craters that coincide with regions predicted to be cold enough for ice to be stable, while dark areas coincide with warmer regions thought to harbor ice only beneath the surface. Page says, quote, Another line of evidence for frozen water comes from MESSENGER's neutron spectrometer, which detects how much hydrogen, and therefore presumably water, is present. Cosmic rays constantly bombard Mercury's surface, breaking apart atomic nuclei and scattering neutrons. When the neutrons collide with hydrogen, they lose energy and grind to a halt like a cue ball hitting a billiard ball, unquote. The dearth of neutrons detected near Mercury's North Pole suggests a lot of hydrogen lies just below the planet's surface, almost certainly as pure ice. The mass of ice could be up to a trillion metric tons. Mercury has an average surface temperature of about 400 degrees Celsius. So how can water, let alone ice, survive there? Well, one of the reasons that the ice could be present at the poles is that Mercury does not tilt on its axis the way the Earth does. Mercury's rotation axis is scarcely tilted. It's less than 1 degree from being totally upright relative to the Sun. That means that the planet never points its poles at the Sun. The ice and any organic compounds that would be at the bottom of a deep polar crater would remain there in permanent shadow. If Mercury has been in this upright position since its birth over 4 billion years ago, it's possible that the ice preserved there could be truly primordial, dating back to the origin of the solar system. Next story. Back when I was a kid, one of the popular books was the weird proto-new agey tome by Eric von Daniken called The Chariots of the Gods. The proposal in von Daniken's book can be simplified that all early human history can be seen through the lens of space aliens coming to Earth, a la the movie Proteus, and guiding human civilization. Among von Daniken's pieces of evidence that aliens visited Earth are the giant drawings of animals and insects on the Nazca Plains of Peru. For those of you who have never heard of these, the Nazca lines are part of a series of ancient giant geoglyphs located in the Nazca Desert in southern Peru. Scholars believe that the Nazca lines were created by the Nazca culture between 400 and 650 AD. The hundreds of individual figures range in complexity from very simple lines to hummingbirds, spiders, monkeys, fish, sharks, giant killer whales, and lizards. The lines themselves are shallow designs made in the ground by removing the reddish pebbles and uncovering the whitish-grayish ground underneath. And there are hundreds of these. The largest figure is over 650 feet across. Von Daniken suggested that airborne extraterrestrials laid out the lines as runways for their aircraft. After all, the geoglyphs are so huge that the drawings can't really be seen very well from the ground, so how could they have been made on the plains 1,500 years ago, except by aliens? Well, there are a few problems with von Daniken's far-out idea. First, it's claimed that the soil is not hard enough to sustain repeated landings of heavy aerial craft. Second, why did the alleged extraterrestrials not design something far more sophisticated than what they scratched into the soil? Seems rather simplistic for an advanced alien culture. And third, a lot of those lines are only like 3 feet wide, which is way too narrow for aircraft. In addition, von Daniken never explained the overall meaning and purpose of the animal and insect geoglyphs. Why not just a simple runway, after all? So if they are not alien landing locations, a la the Stargate movie, what are those drawings? Dr. Clive Ruggles of the University of Leicester suggests that they are something very different. In this month's volume of the journal Antiquity, Ruggles proposes that the lines are actually parts of labyrinths, mazes. In at least one particular figure, Dr. Ruggles has found that the Nazca lines were single paths leading to and from earthen mounds with a series of disorienting twists and turns over about 4.5 kilometers. Ruggles states, quote, "Those who traversed the desert path encountered 15 sharp corners that ushered them down trails leading away from and back toward a large hill. Walkers then rounded a curve in the path and negotiated 2 more turns before entering a spiral passageway that dumped them a mere 65 yards from the starting point. It probably took about an hour to complete the journey," unquote. Ruggles explains in the articles that there is minimal damage to the walking paths he has discerned. He suggests that that probably means that the labyrinth walkers walked with care, and that religious pilgrims who periodically crossed the plateau on the way to nearby Nazca ritual centers steered clear of or were directed away from the labyrinth. Ruggles' hypothesis that the Nazca labyrinths were made to be strolled through while staying mostly hidden from view is novel and a well-argued point in the article, and it certainly makes more sense from a historical viewpoint than the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Next story. For fans of Star Trek the movie, which featured V'ger, or those of you who are just old enough to remember its launch, or fans of the Moody Blues album Long Distance Voyager, this month marks a special time for our long-departed spacecraft, Voyager. Voyager, which is the farthest bit of our civilization which has been moving away from us for about 35 years, is finally nearing the very edge of our solar system. A NASA press release states that Voyager has just encountered a, quote, magnetic highway of charged particles, unquote, a hint that the spacecraft may not have far to go before reaching the brink of interstellar space. According to NASA, that so-called highway is where the sun's magnetic field and the interstellar magnetic field meet. Particles blown outward from the solar wind are speeding in one direction, while particles from cosmic rays generated outside the solar system are racing in. Voyager 1 and 2 were launched 16 weeks apart in 1977 and are the most distant human-made objects in the known universe. Voyager 1 is now more than 123 times as far from Earth as the planet is from the Sun, and Voyager 2 is about 100 times as far. For the past 7 years, the spacecraft has been in an outer region of the solar system called the heliosheath, where the solar wind particles slow down and bounce around in all directions. So what is Voyager going to finally find when it leaves the heliosphere region that defines the edge in the official solar system? Dr. David McComas of NASA states, quote, "We think we will find a magnetic field oriented more in a north-south direction, and we've detected radio waves of a few kilohertz, but we could be quite surprised once we get out of the bubble," unquote. I suspect the only thing that would really surprise them would be an alien spacecraft collecting Voyager as a memento of their vacation to the Sol system. Let's stick to astronomy for just a moment. Here is a variation on a theme for you guys who are getting sick of the monthly exoplanet report. I was reminded of the 1970s TV show Space 1999 when I read this particular report. For those of you who missed the show, it was the adventures of a space colony on the moon when the moon was blown out of Earth's orbit accidentally by a gigantic nuclear explosion. Once free of the Earth, Luna became sort of a free agent floating out of the solar system. A bit like Voyager, in fact. In the journal Astrophysics and Astronomy this month, Dr. Philippe Delorme of the Institute of Planetology and Astrophysics of Grenoble, France, reports on a rogue planet that his group has found in a group of stars about 120 light-years from Earth. It's not a planet in the conventional sense because it doesn't orbit a star, but it's between 4 and 7 times the mass of Jupiter, and that's well within planetary size ranges. The object appears to be young and cold, and in a cluster of about 30 stars moving together called AB Doradus. Other potential free-floating planets have been detected before, but their ages have not been calculable, like this one. Astronomers couldn't be sure the objects were planets and not brown dwarfs previously. A brown dwarf is a failed star too small to sustain a fusion reaction. The newfound object, which has been dubbed in a most poetic manner CFBD-SIR-2149, lies in the southern constellation Dorado. Scientists estimate that the planet is between 20 million and 200 million years old, based on the age of the stars that accompany it. Delorme says, quote, "It's like a one-year-old baby versus a 45-year-old man. To me, this planet is a prototype of exoplanets we are looking for around other stars," unquote. Free-floating planets were first discovered about 10 years ago in the constellation Orion. A couple of dozen have been found since, but scientists don't know how common these planetary drifters are. How these floaters form also remains a mystery. They might have been planets that were kicked out of orbit around their star, or they could have been formed more like brown dwarfs just from collapsing clouds of gas and dust. Although it's pretty unlikely they were released through nuclear explosions, I suspect. Up next, are your guts as good as your fingerprints? I expect a few huhs from that question. I can understand that. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Let me explain. In the newest issue of the journal Nature, Dr. George Weinstock of Washington University reports on the bacteria in your gut and how unique it is compared to other people. In the first ever study to catalog genetic variation of microbes in the human gut, Weinstein and his group identified a remarkable amount of variation in the genomes of gut microbes, more than in the human genome, in fact. Also, they showed for the first time that those differences vary from person to person and actually remain stable over time. Weinstock states, quote, "Each of us has a personalized gut microbial fingerprint, and knowledge about that unique profile could improve human health and medicine," unquote. In the paper, they analyzed the DNA sequences of 252 stool samples obtained from the NIH Microbiome Project. Then they compared those sequences with reference genomes from 101 microbes, including E. coli, Streptococcus, and Clostridium. It turns out that microbes in an individual's gut have, on average, one genetic variant or single nucleotide polymorphism per 150 nucleotides. A single nucleotide polymorphism is literally a single nucleotide change between individuals, or organisms, or populations. The human genome has about one variant for every 1,000 nucleotides, so one per every 150 is quite a bit of variation. Weinstock states about this variation, quote, "There seems to be more variation in bacteria than in humans, which makes sense. They divide faster than we do and are more versatile when responding to selective pressures in their environment," unquote. Most of that genetic variation was found in genes that require versatility, such as antibiotic resistance genes. Areas of least variation occurred in genes coding for proteins that interact with the host and are necessary to survive in a hostile gut environment. A subset of the samples in the study included 43 individuals who were sampled multiple times. From these samples, the team concluded that an individual's collection of microbial strains is maintained over time, though the abundance of individual microbes may increase or decrease. Again, here's Weinstein's comment, quote, "Your unique individualized microbiome is stable and distinguishable from other people. It's just like your human genome. Slight differences in yours and mine distinguish us from each other," unquote. Weinstein says the goal of the study is to aid in medical diagnoses and to find out how our collection of gut bugs can someday be manipulated to improve effectiveness of certain medications. However, I wonder if he's thinking something else entirely, an entirely new form of human biometrics, perhaps? As his study pointed out, each gut's bacteria is unique and stable. So, well, Dr. Weinstein, are you suggesting that we use feces as the new fingerprint? I'm just wondering. You can get back to me on that. I'm just not so sure how popular it will be at police stations and banks. That's all. All right. I'm sorry. I've been spending way too much time with my 4 and 6-year-olds. In case you don't believe I can gross you out even more, the next story is from the Journal of Experimental Biology this month and is all about soft-shell turtles. Innocent enough so far, huh? Dr. Ip Yung Kwan and colleagues from the National University of Singapore have discovered that soft-shell turtles have an unusual way of getting rid of their liquid nitrogenous waste. Read that as urine. Kwan found that Chinese soft-shelled turtles pass waste through their mouths. Biologists have been puzzled for years by the turtle's behavior because despite its having lungs to breathe air, it often submerges its head underwater for quite a long time. By testing the water, Kwan's group found that the reptile was excreting urea through its mouth instead of its kidneys. The discovery adds to previous research, which suggested that turtles have highly specialized mouth tissues. So yes, these turtles are urinating through their mouths. Kwan and other scientists noted that these species occasionally submerge their heads into pools of water for up to 100 minutes at a time. Quad originally brought a turtle into the lab to study why they didn't drown and to observe what else may be happening. He provided it with water and observed as it regularly dipped its head and rinsed water through its mouth. Quan said, quote, "The urea excretion rate through the mouth was significantly greater, 15 to 49-fold, than it was through the cloaca," unquote. A cloaca is the single orifice used for waste matter and reproduction in lots of reptiles and birds. Quan further stated, quote, "The ability to pass waste through the mouth was unique to this species. We were greatly surprised by our novel results because it is generally accepted that the kidney is responsible for excretion of urea in vertebrates, except fish." Unquote. Quan does not clarify where he thinks the urea is coming from, but he does suggest that some animals, such as cattle, recycle nitrogen waste in their saliva. Ew. Okay, let's finish the science podcast on a slightly cleaner note. This story is from the journal The Scientist. Dr. Taras Olesik, a young researcher at the University of Puerto Rico, has decided to sequence the DNA genome of the native parrot of Puerto Rico, and he certainly has the support of the island. The Puerto Rican parrot, the only parrot species native to the island, once flirted with extinction and is still critically endangered. By the early 1970s, the population had dwindled to about 16 birds. By 2011, an estimated 100 parrots were born in the wild or released from Puerto Rico's captive breeding program. While the success of the reintroduction program was certainly cause for rejoicing, the fact that the population bottomed out so dramatically just 40 years ago means that today's birds are likely quite inbred with low genetic diversity. Sequencing the parrot's genome could not only serve as a tool for studying the current genetic variation of the Puerto Rican parrot, but could also help identify genetic changes that accompany the diversification of ancestral parrot species. Dr. Olesik seems to be on a one-man crusade. Olesik reached out to the Genome 10K project, which is aimed at sequencing the genomes of 10,000 vertebrate species to improve conservation efforts worldwide for money. The request was not turned down, but the group had already chosen 17 bird species to sequence that year, and wouldn't be able to take on the Puerto Rican parrot until 2013 at the earliest. Dr. Olesik apparently has less patience than even I do because he didn't want to wait. But the problem was he didn't have the thousands of dollars needed to actually perform the project. That was when he saw some paintings of the island parrot, which had been done by his graduate student's sister to help raise awareness about the project. He decided one way to raise money would be to sell the paintings to help the sequencing cause. They were able to do the initial sequencing for just $2,000 raised from the art. And then, to do the sequencing in more depth, they raised another $2,000 from a second art show. After that, they brought in an additional $2,000 from a fashion show, as well as contributed cash and donated products from local businesses and individuals. In all, so far, the team has raised a total of about $8,000, which funded additional sequencing runs that increased the coverage and improved the assembly of the DNA fragments. In addition to inspiring the Puerto Rican community, the project has also motivated the university. In October, the University of Puerto Rico launched a new Genome Center, which proudly bears the parrot as its logo. And it now offers a parrot DNA annotation class in which students are given a portion of a parrot chromosome to search for genes and regulatory elements. Olesik has apparently hit the big time now with two recent $20,000 contributions from the Toyota Foundation and the Fish and Wildlife Management Office of Puerto Rico, which oversees the captive parrot breeding program. The research group now has enough money to look at a greater number of samples and to begin assessing individual genetic variation. Olesik says, quote, "The problem with that population is it's extremely inbred. There might still be parts of the genome that harbor diversity you might want to preserve," unquote. What do I have to say about this parrot business? Feliz Navidad and Prospero Año. And that's about it. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Ignore the advice of any Mayans you may come across. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.